Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
And now she's tried to shift to a more palatable position on this election denialism that allows her some level of deniability, but is still rooted in those same core conspiracies.
What U.S. Senate candidate Kelly Chewbacca says about the 2020 election. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how the state's election workers are dealing with skepticism from voters.
They still seem to believe the MyPillow guy before they'll believe me or even some of our regional supervisors.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
A group tracking U.S. political extremism has labeled Sarah Palin and Kelly Chewbacca as election deniers. They're the two Alaska congressional candidates endorsed by Donald Trump. Chewbacca has offered a mix of statements on the 2020 election, but the Renew America Foundation says she's still taking positions detrimental to democracy. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Palin is clear-cut. When asked on a candidate survey, do you believe Joe Biden won the presidential election in 2020? She responded, no. Chewbacca's statement is longer. Joe Biden is president, she acknowledged in the survey response, but she went on to list questions about the 2020 election. She repeated unfounded allegations brought by Trump and his allies, none of which produced evidence of widespread fraud that held up in court. And in the days after the 2020 election, Chewbacca wrote a post for a right-wing blog calling for unity, but she embraced a longer string of unfounded allegations.
She went even more extreme than that statement, talking about conspiracy theories about glitches in computer programs and some of the more radical and thoroughly debunked conspiracy theories about elections in other states.
Mike Ongsted is a spokesman for the Renew America Foundation, which tracks election denialism and other threats to democracy.
And now she's tried to shift to a more palatable position on this election denialism that allows her some level of deniability, but is still rooted in those same core conspiracies and is still having the same detrimental effect on our democracy by undermining confidence and stoking fear and anger about the outcome of our elections.
The Chewbacca campaign did not respond to inquiries for this story, but she did say recently that she would accept the results of her own election.
If we think that the election was done in a way where we don't believe that there was something that went super wrong, absolutely. If Alaskans pick somebody else, then that's what Alaskans pick.
Chewbacca is challenging incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski. Murkowski lost the support of the state Republican Party, in part because she voted to convict Trump at his second impeachment, a case rooted in Trump's refusal to accept his election defeat. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Misinformation, skepticism, and hostility around Alaska's election integrity are taking their toll on election workers. Alaska Public Media reporter Jeremy Shea talked with several officials with the State Division of Elections recently ahead of Election Day. That's Tuesday next week, November 8th. Hello, Jeremy.
Hey, Casey.
So what are state election officials most concerned about lately?
Well, first off, they say they are not concerned about the actual integrity of election. They say there's a solid system of checks and balances in place that have long proved that Alaska's elections are fair, honest, and secure. They say they've got that down. Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer, who's responsible for oversight of the Division of Elections, he says his biggest concern is actually homegrown misinformation from social media, especially. Election officials have been spending a lot of time addressing the public's election concerns. Meyer says some people just can't be convinced.
They still seem to believe the MyPillow guy before they'll believe me or even some of our regional supervisors. So that's been a little frustrating, and I don't know how we can get around that.
So Meyer's talking about Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow. That guy's more famous now for promoting false claims about election fraud than for his own business. Meyer said when he began the job 4 years ago, malicious foreign actors were top of mind. He says they're still in play, but now skeptics like Lindell and his supporters are complementing foreign efforts to undermine our democracy.
Does all this scrutiny and skepticism have an impact on how the state runs elections?
Yeah, so the division's processes and procedures haven't changed much. Substantive changes really have to be changed in state law, which doesn't happen often. But there are other impacts. Lieutenant Governor Meyer said one regional election supervisor told him he felt like he was going to get punched in the face during a recent primary. That supervisor quit, and Meyer said it was already tough to recruit and retain election workers without a sometimes abusive work environment. So fortunately, the division's longtime operations manager says she's not aware of any major personal threats against Alaska election workers, like the sort that have been reported in other states. But the election workers issue is a real issue. If there aren't enough, that can mean longer lines and fewer polling places. Meyer said finding workers is especially tough in rural Alaska. And if the situation doesn't get better, Alaska may have to switch to an entirely vote-by-mail system.
Huh. So you mentioned that there are a lot of checks and balances to ensure our elections are accurate. Can you walk me through some of those checks and balances?
Yeah, so one of the most common concerns is that the machines that scan our ballots and count our votes are error-prone or may have been intentionally manipulated somehow to alter vote counts. So for the sake of argument, let's say the scanner I feed my ballot into at my polling place after I vote is somehow compromised. Election workers actually test these machines before they're used in the field, so it would likely get caught through one of those tests before any real ballots were scanned. After a ballot is scanned, it isn't discarded, so that physical paper is still there. With a few exceptions, state law requires a hand count of those physical ballots from one randomly selected precinct for every House district in the state. So that's 40 recounts, basically. If a hand count is off of the machine count by more than 1%, that's a red flag. And they started doing this back in 1998, and they've never hit that threshold. The discrepancies they do find are usually caused by ballots that are poorly marked that the machines can't read. Meyer said the Division of Elections took things further after the 2020 election. They did a hand count of the statewide vote for a close ballot measure question, the one that led to open primaries and ranked choice voting. So across hundreds of individual voting precincts, the vast majority were spot on, no errors at all. Some were off by a few votes in one direction or the other. The hand count of more than 340,000 ballots showed a net change of 171 fewer votes. The overall ratio of yes and no votes didn't really change. It was about 1/100 of 1%.
Interesting, yeah. So are the machines themselves secure?
Yeah, in two ways. So physically, when they're not in use, they're stored in monitored rooms with alarms on them. Access is limited and logged. Carol Thompson has been with the Division of Elections for 32 years and now manages election operations. She says she's dealt with her share of 2 a.m. alarms from these.
So if somebody were to break in, bells and whistles will go off, okay. Including if it's a mouse.
Which has actually happened. As far as Ocean's 11 Dream Team of hackers and burglars, not so much. The other way machines are secured is through an air gap. That's like a techie way of saying the machines involved in counting votes are not on any networks. They don't talk to each other electronically. They don't have Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. Between the air gap and physical security measures, the idea is they can't be hacked. An election security official says the scanners at precincts do briefly get connected to an external cellular modem to transmit results, then unplugged. But again, there are checks to make sure that what was sent matches what was received, and there's another air gap to get those results into tabulator machines.
Gotcha. Air gaps. I hadn't heard that before. Jeremy, let's just zoom out a little here. The Division of Elections says they've already received about 38,000 ballots, mostly from absentee voters by mail and early in-person voters. Can those voters verify that their ballots were received?
Yeah, it kind of depends. So for people who've jumped through the hoops to specifically request an absentee ballot, and the language here is kind of you have to be pretty precise about it. Yeah, you can call your regional elections office or go to myvoterinformation.alaska.gov and see when your ballot was sent to you and when or if the Division of Elections has received it. Early voting in person is different. Those ballots are treated more like regular election day ballots. They go right into the state's custody. So that's receipt, but you can't really check if your specific ballot has actually been counted. That's because various types of ballots get pooled together before they're counted, and that's sort of a trade-off with the right to a secret ballot.
Okay. That was Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea. Jeremy, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a nursing program in Bethel trains students to work in their communities.
I get to see elders cared for by nursing students who are from the same village, and it's a beautiful thing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Voting in the general election? Here are key deadlines you need to know. First, in-person voting begins on October 24th. Want to vote absentee? You must request your ballot by October 29th. Last is Election Day. You must vote or submit your ballot by November 8th. Visit elections.alaska.gov to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Elections.
Students in the Western Alaska community of Kipnuk are without some of their teachers or a principal. Starting Wednesday, they will shift to remote learning following an apparent dispute between the school district and the Kipnuk Traditional Council. 2 weeks ago, the council sent a letter to all Kipnuk households prohibiting children in the village of around 700 people from attending school, citing concerns for the physical safety of students. On Monday, the Lower Kuskokwim School District released a statement announcing the school's closure. It also cited concerns for the safety of students and staff. Kipnuk's traditional council has not agreed to comment. The reasons for the dispute are unclear, but class was canceled Monday and Tuesday at the Chief Paul Memorial School, and students will shift to remote learning beginning Wednesday until further notice. The school closure comes just days after the Kipnuk Traditional Council wrote a formal banishment letter to the school's principal, LaDorothy Lightfoot, calling for her to leave the village on the noon flight Friday. According to a dispatch report, Alaska State Troopers received a call from LKSD reporting Lightfoot had locked herself in her office after village law enforcement tried to take her into custody. Troopers arrived in Kipnuk Saturday to find the boardwalk between the airport and village blocked. They were able to de-escalate the situation and meet with the principal and staff at the school. The school district chartered two flights and some staff left the village. The state district attorney's office has been contacted. No crimes have been committed and no threats were made, according to troopers. Kipnuk School will be closed to the public during remote learning. Some staff will teach remotely from Bethel. Four Anchorage residents have sued Democratic State House candidate Jenny Armstrong and the Alaska Division of Elections, saying Armstrong is ineligible to run for office. As the Alaska Beacon reports, the lawsuit claims that a social media post and fishing licenses prove Armstrong did not live in Alaska for the required 3 years before registering as a candidate for office. The four plaintiffs in the lawsuit filed Friday are all registered Republicans, and public records show three have donated financially to Liz Vasquez, a Republican and an Armstrong opponent in the November 8th election. Armstrong's campaign manager, Arielle Wiggin, said that the deadline for residency challenges passed months ago and that the lawsuit is likely intended to confuse voters. The suit was first noted online by Jeff Landfield, an Anchorage political writer, who was also the first to raise public concerns about Armstrong's eligibility. After Landfield's initial writing, the Alaska Division of Elections said it had no plans to investigate Armstrong's eligibility and that its initial certification of her candidacy was based upon information Armstrong provided when she registered. Armstrong finished first in the state's August 16th primary and has been seen as the frontrunner in the district. Slot machines, like most kinds of gambling, aren't legal in Alaska, but in the Prince of Wales Island community of Klawak, The local tribe is now running more than 20 machines that look an awful lot like the kind of slots you might find on the floor of a Las Vegas casino. And it's all perfectly legal. KRBD's Reagan Miller explains.
Rhonda Wren drove from Gregg to Klawock 2 days in a row to play the machines at the Klawock Casino.
I had lots of luck yesterday. I did great.
Nearby, Robert Baza was coming away from his machine with $300. He had heard that the Klawock Cooperative Association opened the casino early last month and wanted to try it out.
It's pretty good. It's paying off.
Gaming isn't new to Klawock. Before COVID-19 came to the island, the tribe hosted regular bingo games and pull tabs. But now, they've added more than 20 bingo machines to the casino, which share space with the tribe's mini-mart and smoke shop in the heart of town. The machines look nearly identical to slot machines. But technically, they're electronic bingo machines. And in most places in Alaska, they're illegal under state law, even under an exception that allows nonprofits to run raffles and bingo games. But here in Klawock, there's a twist. The casino sits on land held by the federal government in a trust. It predates the landmark Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Lloyd Miller is an attorney with the firm Sinotsky Chambers, based in Anchorage.
I mean, this is land held in trust for the benefit of the tribe.
The tribe's operation is legal under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. The law provides a framework for what kinds of gaming is legal in areas defined as Indian country. Miller says that's what makes it different from a recent case with some striking similarities. In 2018, the native village of Iklutna tried to open a similar slot-like electronic bingo hall in Chugiak, but they were shot down by state authorities and a federal court. Miller's firm was involved in that case. It's a little complicated, but Miller says it all comes down to land. The key problem? Iklutna wanted to open the casino on a native allotment, land that belonged to tribal members, not the tribe itself.
And when you're talking about an allotment instead of trust land, you then get into a secondary question about that asks whether the tribe has jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction over the allotment.
And to qualify, the land needs to be under full jurisdiction of the tribe.
Allotment awarded to an individual as a former chief. I mean, this goes way back in time. It was not a parcel of land taken into trust for the tribe, for the benefit of the tribe, and held in trust for the benefit of the tribe. That's a big difference.
But Klawock does have jurisdiction over the casino parcel. The tribe also has the appropriate Class 2 license from the National Indian Gaming Commission to go with it. A Class 2 license covers things like pull tabs and bingo, including the slot-style electronic machines. It's a step behind a Class 3 license that would allow for Vegas-style games with big jackpots. That's why, equipped with the right kind of land and the right kind of license, Klawock's casino is in business. Miller says there are other small parcels of trust land like Klawock's, like in Angoon. Back at the casino, tribal administrator Lawrence Armour says revenue from the casino helps the federally recognized tribe support its members and the community.
Just starting another enterprise. I mean, the smoke shop is what we pay a lot of our tribal employee salaries with if they're not covered by a grant. And we just needed another revenue source. So it was just one of the ideas that we started discussing, and the opportunity kind of fell in our laps.
Armour says he's seen Klawock residents come to test their luck, but also plenty of unfamiliar faces, too. Klawock's casino is the only one on Prince of Wales Island. But Armour says that may not be for long.
I think there are some tribes that were looking into it, so we were really trying to keep it under wraps as far as progress and who our contacts were to try to get this thing off and beat them to the punch, basically.
Armour says business has been steady. He says he thinks the machines will usher in a new interest in tribal gaming and even push out old standbys like pull tabs. Reporting in Klawock, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction with over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience. Your future is in your hands, whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level. Discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Heavy snow and early summer heat have cut Alaska's hay harvest in half and doubled the price of feed. So livestock producers are considering thinning their herds while struggling with high fuel and fertilizer prices. Experts are warning Alaska farmers to expect continued unseasonable weather, and as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, they've scheduled workshops next month to help farmers plan for the new normal.
Heavy snowfall last winter delayed Delta Junction area farmers from getting their hay crops in the ground last spring by at least 2 weeks, and then it warmed up.
All that snow that we had, man, it just disappeared. It went from all that snow to pretty dry quite quickly.
UAF Cooperative Extension Service Agent Phil Kaspari says that was followed by warmer than usual early summer weather in both the interior and the Mat-Su, the state's biggest agricultural areas, and then a wetter than usual July and August, especially in South Central.
So they had a really tough haying season. And the long and the short of it is there's a serious lack of forage and, unfortunately, grain for feeding livestock.
Kaspari says farmers were already facing high fuel and fertilizer costs when planting season began. Alaska Farm Bureau Board President Scott Mugridge says he paid 40% more for those commodities and got only about half of last year's yield from this year's first hay harvest in late June.
So the fertilizer and fuel going up and the amount of yield going down is kind of a twofold kick, you know.
Mugridge grows feed and raises livestock at his Delta area farm, and he says it was a tough year for grains, too. He says he harvested only about half of the barley and oats that he'd anticipated this year.
And that was due to the dry weather plus an early frost we had back in late July.
Kaspari says the low supply and high cost of feed and other necessities forced many producers to reduce their herds by slaughtering livestock, putting more strain on the industry.
Because when you start eliminating breeding stock, it takes years to build these herds back up.
And that hurts the farmers who grow the feed.
The livestock industry is the economic engine for so much of what Alaskan agriculture is all about, providing feed for that industry.
Farmers have always operated on slim margins and relied on good weather, or at least predictable weather, but climate change has altered those familiar patterns, and researchers now believe a long-term drying trend is underway in the state.
Alaska is in areas where we're experiencing drought.
Jody Anderson is the interim director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Agricultural and Forestry Experiment Station. She says dry weather is especially hard on plants that are just beginning to sprout, and it's a problem for so-called dry land farming, a type of cultivation that doesn't require irrigation, which until recently worked pretty well.
Here in Alaska, we dry land farm, but we get plenty of moisture from the atmosphere, the natural patterns, and those are changing. And, we're going to have to start irrigating.
Some farmers around the state do irrigate, but Anderson says it'll likely have to be done more widely to grow more food for both livestock and humans. She says state and federal agencies haven't formally declared a drought in Alaska, but she says researchers with those agencies will talk about the problem in workshops to be held on November 14th in Delta and 16th in Palmer.
Is an opportunity for education so that farmers can maybe farm a little smarter to manage their water better so that even in drier times, they're still going to be okay.
Anderson says the workshops are intended mainly for farmers and others in the agriculture industry, but members of the public may virtually attend the meeting in Palmer over the Zoom platform. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
There's a nationwide need for nurses, but it's especially acute in Alaska. The state is increasingly reliant on out-of-state healthcare workers, which is an expensive short-term fix. In Bethel, a remote satellite of the state's university system focuses on teaching nurses from the community to stay close to home and work in the local hospital. KTOO's Claire Strempel reports.
It's a frosty Saturday morning, and Amber Bukowski leans into Melanie McIntyre's car to give her a flu shot and a drive-through clinic.
One, two, three.
He wants me
Bukowski pulls off her lavender gloves and has a small bandage ready. McIntyre turns to the back seat to tell her kids it's not so bad.
It's like a mosquito bite or like a little pinch. That's all.
This is one of many flu shots Bukowski will give today. She's putting in hours towards her nursing degree from the Kuskokwim campus, a satellite of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's part of the long-term solution to the state's dire need for nurses, Alaska-trained nurses, who intend to work in the state. Twila Elhart is the program's instructor.
We have a huge shortage of healthcare workers here.
Elhart came to Bethel as a nurse in 2015, but became a nursing instructor a couple of years ago. She said that's because she has a passion for seeing students from the region learn to take care of its residents.
I get to see elders cared for by nursing students who are from the same village, and it's a beautiful thing, and I'd love to see that increase.
She says local nurses break down barriers to care because they understand where their patients are coming from.
They want to be here for the long haul. I think you just have an amazing investment, not just in a direct patient care, but into the whole healthcare system.
Bukowski, the student from the flu clinic, got her start in Shivak, where she's from originally.
I started out as a health aide in the village clinics and transferred over to be a supervisor and took classes part-time and then ended up in the nursing program.
After final exams in December, she and the other three students in her cohort will take the test to become fully certified nurses in Bethel.
It's a lot of info. A lot of hard work and dedication, but anybody can do it.
Her classmate, Michael Vicente, worked as a public health official for the hospital in Bethel until he started the nursing program 2 years ago.
Well, with my job, I was already doing public health, so this is like the next step into go working closer with the community on a one-on-one basis.
I know, for real.
Out in the parking lot, his presence soothes an unsure flu shot recipient.
Nice job, man. Good job.
He and the rest of the students work closely with the hospital staff to quickly vaccinate community members.
Oh, hey, Carmen.
Many of whom they can greet by name. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Claire Strempel.
Finally tonight, we have a correction to a story yesterday about an increase in text messages from political candidates. A campaign manager had said campaigns can get voters' phone numbers from state election data, but state election officials say it's actually more complicated than that. Information from voter records like names, addresses, and party affiliation is public. Phone numbers are not, but campaigns buy other data sets and cross-reference them with voter records to get the numbers. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Nina Kravinsky and Claire Strempel in Bethel, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert. Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 45 years of Alaska operations. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.